Good evening. Thank you all for being here tonight. I hear myself pretty well, so I imagine that you can too. Great. Thank you for your brisk chanting. I hope you feel like you had a nice run around the block. Yeah. Have people sign liability forms before we chant the Genjo Kon. I'm going to change things up a bit tonight. I will talk for a while, and then Dirk has agreed to play a short clip for us on this big screen, which is why folks are behind me tonight rather than off to the side. And then I'll talk some more. I have a fair amount to say tonight, and I hope there will be time for discussion afterward. We'll see. If there is, my wish is for you all to break up into small groups rather than to have one big open discussion. I think that it might be a little more fitting for tonight's topic. Many of my Dharma talks, many of the talks that I offer here and elsewhere, are a combination of what I would call Zen and humanism. And humanism includes the sciences, the hard and soft sciences, as we say. It includes established and emerging, sorry, I'm getting used to my ways of reasoning and understanding. It includes cross-disciplinary expressions of psychosocial intelligence based on different disciplines of observation and reasoning, or you could say based on the study of cause and effect, which is so much of what Buddhism teaches and encourages us to study, the early Buddhist teachings in particular, but also later Mahayana teachings like Yogacara, which is also quite old. So my talk tonight will be another talk that integrates Zen and modern humanism. And it has been informed by recent events, as well as long-standing social dynamics and issues that many of us are familiar with. Going forward, I'm also going to be making more of an effort to situate my talks in a moment in time, so to speak, in order to remind us frequently that the present moment is situated between the past and the future, even while it's dynamic and ever-changing. It's situated in a long history, to say nothing of beginningless time. And from this situated and fleeting moment flows our future. A future that in this very moment you and I are always significantly contributing to the formation of the next moment. So together we are shaping, and some might even say determining, what happens next. I'm working with this hypothesis. Hypothesis is an educated prediction, you know, that serves as a starting point for an experiment. Zen is an experiment that we're all engaged in. The hypothesis is that the more we remind ourselves and one another of this situatedness and the power that we have in each moment, to shape the future, the better able we'll be to determine how we want that future to be. Informed by what we've learned from the past. So how we want it to be in the next moment, the next day, the next year, the next generation. In this way, we get to be conscious and intentional participants in a shared world. One of the things that I can raise up about this present moment in which we in this room are situated, variously situated, is the simple fact that I am a female-bodied woman with the preferred pronouns she, her. And there appear to be a number of us here tonight. Thank you very much for coming. When I was here last Thursday during Valley Stream's weekly study group, I was the only woman in the room, as is often the case. So, and I noticed, as is often the case. And I can also raise up my situatedness as a person of color. More specifically, a black woman of African American and Latina descent. Whether there is or not there is anyone in this room who identifies as a person of color, I see maybe one other person who may, but I don't know, so pardon me if you feel misidentified. The fact is that I am, this is normally my situated experience in North American Zen Buddhist sanghas. And this has a history, a long history, rooted in things that we don't like to talk about in Zen, segregation, discrimination, oppression, racism, and outright sanctioned violence against black and brown bodies in this country and all over the world. I'm also in a teaching role. I, in my teaching role in this Sangha, am 20 to 25 years younger than many of the longtime members of this Sangha. But I have been invited by Valley Streams to inhabit this role as a teacher due to my many years of formal Zen training and study, and the fact that a number of, I think maybe four, current and former abbots have vouched for me. So I'm sitting here situated at this vital dynamic intersection of up power. I'm up front, but I'm not really on the dais. You know, this up power and down power circumstances with a long history, you know, a present and a potential future. Sitting here tonight in this room on this planet, we have the freedom to some extent and the power to decide how we want our future together to be. I don't say that we dictate what's going to happen, you know, but we can bring the power and intentionality of our practice to bear upon our individual and collective consciousness and upon what manifests from our consciousness, from our body, speech, and minds. This is the nature of the self that I'm talking about. Its capacities, its tendencies, its resistances, and its potential for transformation are what we study and cultivate on the Bodhisattva path, the Zen path, for the welfare of all beings. This path of practice realization is meant to be a path of transformation. Norman Fisher wrote a book titled Another World is Possible. And I heard that there was at least one person in the study group who was interested in reading this book next. I've read this book, and in it, Norman emphasizes the power of imagination. And elsewhere, we don't see the word imagination so much in the teaching of Buddha Dharma. But we talk a lot about intention. And intention implies imagining, you know, envisioning how the next moment can be, or is likely to be, based on the prior moment, based on prior causes and conditions. In a moment, Dirk is going to share with us a brief clip, about 10 minutes. I'm sorry I didn't bring any snacks. It's a video recording of a panel of scientists, spiritual teachers, and artists that convened in Amsterdam in 1990 to discuss the emergence of a new paradigm, a new worldview, based on a fundamental shift in our basic framework for understanding existence and how things work. They convened to discuss, this is their description, the holistic implications of a new paradigm for transforming global relations, presumably for the better. Featured in this clip is the theoretical physicist David Bohm, who is also known for his work in the field of neuropsychology and for his deep exploration and articulation of the nature of consciousness. Bohm died in 1992, and in the early 80s, I think maybe it was early 1980, in fact, he wrote a very interesting book that became well received far beyond the world of physics, titled Wholeness and the Implicate Order. And just behind him on this panel, smiling, as usual, you will see a very familiar face. So Dirk, whenever you're ready, would you please play the clip for us?
We are internally related to everything, yes. Not externally related. Consciousness is an internal relationship to the whole. We take in the whole, and we act toward the whole. And yeah. That internal, whatever we have taken in, determines basically what we are.
Quantum physicist and philosopher David Bohm was profoundly affected by his close contacts with both Einstein and Jay Krishnamurti. Bohm's theory of wholeness and the implicate order states that there is something like life and mind enfolded in everything.
Well, you see, I think the difficulty is this fragmentation, first of all. Everybody is, all thought is broken up into bits, like this nation, this country, this industry, this profession, and so on, and they can't meet. And it's extremely hard to break into that. Now, The second, but that comes about primarily because thought has developed traditionally in a way such that it claims not to be affecting anything but just telling you the way things are. Therefore, people cannot see that they are creating a problem and then apparently trying to solve it. That is, see, let's take the problem, what problem do you like, pollution, or the ecology. See, the ecology is not in itself a problem. It works perfectly well by itself. It's due to us, right? It's a problem because we are thinking in a certain way by breaking everything up and each person's doing his own thing, right? Now, therefore, the ecological problem is due to thought, right? But thought thinks it is a problem out there and I must solve it. Now, that doesn't make sense because simultaneously thought is doing all the activities which make the problem and then does another set of activities to try to overcome it. You see, it doesn't stop doing the things which are making the ecological problem, right? Or the national problem, or whatever the problem is. The earth is one household, really.
Yeah.
We're not treating it that way, right? So that's the first step in economics, is to say the earth is one household and all that it depends on. It's all one, you see. So now the implicate order would help us to see that, to see everything enfolds everything, that everybody not merely depends on everybody, but actually everybody is everybody in a deeper sense. See, we are the earth because all our substance comes from the earth and goes back. I mean, it's wrong to say it's an environment, you see, just surrounding us, because that would be like trying the brain regarding the stomach as part of its environment. Or the root of the word compassion, you see, to feel together. And if people feel have the same feeling together and are responsible for each other, then you have compassion.
And you don't think it's part of, what's the word, original sin, that human beings in their very nature compete?
Well, I don't think that there is such thing as original sin, and I think it has developed more and more with the growth of our society, that there's no evidence that people in the hunter-gatherer society were all that competitive, but the more you made society big and you had organization, you had to get to the top, mm-hmm. the people on the bottom would suffer, there was a drive to compete, naturally.
And do you think that perhaps the desire to compete is a weakness?
Not a weakness, that's a mistake.
Right.
So the first thing we have to do in the long run is to look at our whole way of thinking, which has developed over so many thousands of years. I don't think it was the original way of thinking of the human race at all, but for many complex reasons it came about. Now, that means that people have to make a... they have to participate to make a cooperative effort to have a dialogue, a real dialogue in which we will not merely exchange opinions, but actually listen deeply to the views of other people without resistance. And we cannot do this if we hold to our own opinion and resist the other. It doesn't mean we should accept the other, but we have to be able to look at all the opinions as suspended, as it were, in front of us, without carrying them out, without suppressing them.
Yes. But this wholeness, this new consciousness, this wholeness, is that something that you can only glimpse? Perhaps in, like, as you might have a glimpse of heaven, or is it something scientific? I mean, can you think your way through it?
Not really complete. The wholeness is an attitude or an approach, but it can be given a scientific realization, you see. Because of relativity and quantum theory, we can, if we wish, look on the world as a whole.
See, I began more or less accepting the ideas of Niels Bohr. I wrote a book called Quantum Theory based on that. And I was feeling that the question really was, what is the nature of reality? You see, Bohr's view is based on an epistemology of saying that all we can discuss is our knowledge of reality.
Yeah.
And I felt dissatisfied with that finally. Well, because it did not give any clear concept of reality, you see. It only discussed what could be observed and measured. Now, if you said, okay, that's all it is, then we'd say we will accept it on that basis, but then we would raise the question, what can we say? Well, reality would mean something that would have some existence independently of being known. You see, to say it might be that we would know it, but it did not require that we know it in order to exist.
Yeah.
Now, it was difficult to see how this could be sustained, finally, in Bohr's view. Now, I tried to get some idea of what might be the process which was implied by the mathematics of the quantum theory. And this process is what I call enfoldment, that the mathematics itself suggests a movement in which everything, in which any particular element of space may have a field which unfolds into the whole, and the whole folds and enfolds it to it. So you have this movement, and I call this the implicate or enfolded order, which unfolds into the explicate order where everything is separate. Now, the implicate order, everything is internally related to everything. Everything contains everything, right? So everybody has many experiences of this implicate order. The most obvious one is ordinary consciousness, where consciousness enfolds everything that you know or see, right? And now, it doesn't merely enfold the universe, but also you act according to that content. So, therefore, you are internally related to the whole. In this sense, you act according to your consciousness of the whole. So you're not acting mechanistically in the sense of being pushed and pulled by objects in the surroundings, but rather according to your consciousness of them, you act. Yeah. So if you're not conscious of them, you cannot act intelligently toward them. But the consciousness is really our most immediate experience of this implicate order. And you might think of nets of consciousness that are finer and finer, or we may think of capturing finer and finer aspects of the implicate order. I think there's an intelligence that's implicit there, you see, to say that a kind of intelligence unfolds. The source of intelligence is not necessarily in the brain, you see, the ultimate source, but much more enfolded into the whole. Now, the question of what you want to call God, that depends on what you mean by the word, you see, because taking it as a personal God might restrict it in some way.
I think science has begun to replace religion as the major source of the world view. Therefore, if science takes a fragmentary worldview, it will have a profound effect on consciousness.
But science is always seen as measurement. Is that no longer true?
Well, science is whatever people make of it. You see, science has changed over the ages, and it's different now from a few hundred years ago, and it could be different again. Now, there's no intrinsic reason why science must necessarily be measurement. This is another historical development which has come about over the past few centuries. It's entirely contingent and not absolutely necessary.
And when Einstein produced his special theory,
yeah,
which the Times newspaper of London dismissed,
yeah,
as being nonsense, was he moving towards wholeness?
Yes, he definitely was. He moved eventually toward a view of field theory where everything was one field, all the fields merging. So it was a step toward wholeness, although not, you know, it was a limited step, but still it was the beginning.
And if we get to wholeness, are we then in heaven? I mean, where else is there to go?
We'll never get there. You see, it's not a place you can get. wholeness, I say, is a kind of attitude or an approach to the whole of life. It's a way, if we can have a coherent approach to reality, then reality will respond coherently to us. But nature has been tremendously affected by our way of thinking on the earth. Nature is now being destroyed. There's very little left on the earth which wasn't affected by how we were thinking.
And if we have coherence, in what way will our behavior be seen to be different?
Well, we will produce the results we intend rather than the results we don't intend.
Yes.
That's the first big change. Then we will be more orderly, harmonious, you know, we will be happier. I think we could put all that in there. But the major source of unhappiness is that we are incoherent and therefore producing results that we don't really want. And then trying to overcome them while we keep on producing them.
It was a little longer than I anticipated it would feel. There were some things in the middle there that I thought maybe were not so relevant to our talk, but I really wanted to get to that where we ended. So there was quite a lot said in that short clip, and one could unpack it for really a long time. But tonight, in the short time that we have remaining, I'd like to focus on a few Zen-related practice points. Points for me that are pointing to the question, what gets in the way? What gets in the way of our deep desire for that we tell ourselves and others that we have to live in harmony with our environment, with all beings? I was thinking fundamentally the obvious truth, and I'm sorry to say it bluntly, but we're all adults here. Life feeds on life, necessarily. So it's actually not possible to live without killing in the conventional sense. And yet we vow not to kill. In the deep, you know, the deep meaning of that vow is a topic for a different talk. And the more extravagantly we live, the more extravagantly we take life, which is, you know, as we all know, currently resulting in ecological catastrophe. And although we may not be able to protect and preserve the conditions necessary for the survival of many forms of life on this planet by sitting more zazen and practicing more loving kindness among ourselves in this sangha, our practice does have long tentacles and a great power to interrupt harm, transform afflictions, harmonize, serve as a guide and an encouragement and a reminder to others, and awaken and liberate us from suffering, particularly the suffering of our own making. Most of us have read the label, so it goes without saying, but it doesn't. We need to be reminded, because we have a lot of work to do to bring about the changes that so many of us say we want to see in our life, in this world, in our own lifetimes. Bohm raised a very important point when he said that one of our most basic problems as modern people is that we are deeply resistant to seeing our own incoherence, our contradictions, our conflicting values and desires, and the undesirable effects that they're having in our perceivable lives. What awakening, we might ask ourselves, what awakening does it take for us to feel deeply responsible for what we see going on around us, let alone what we see happening in, you know, distant and foreign lands? It's very hard for us as human beings to live with what we call cognitive dissonance. And, you know, believing ourselves to be, for example, a good person with such and such values, and at the same time, while holding that belief, to be available to clearly see the acts of body, speech, and mind that we're engaged in that keep bringing about the results contrary to the results we tell ourselves we're aiming to bring about in our relationships. Cognitive dissonance is a kind of incoherence, and it's hard to see and hard to feel, hard to tolerate. So most people turn their back, you know, to cognitive dissonance, sweep it under the rug, hold their breath, distract themselves from it, fight. Zazen cultivates the capacity to look directly, see clearly and respond appropriately. To what we otherwise might feel, we might find it impossible, actually, to allow ourselves to see it and feel it, because it requires a certain capacity. You could say that the cultivation of an appropriate response is the cultivation of coherence. Bohm described intelligence as coherent expression. So, what gets in the way of our ability to transform our incoherence, despite all of its painful and collectively disastrous consequences, is not knowing how to work with our karmic formations, past conditioning, with the ways in which we are situated by our conditioning and everyone else's conditioning and the conditioning of our ancestors. So not knowing, I said, how to work with our karmic formations, and I'm thinking specifically about what in Buddhism we call the hindrances and the afflictions, or the kleshas. It's been said that the five kleshas are like the quality of the soil, or the quality of the mind ground. While the kleshas are the mental or emotional affects or expressions that rise up out of that soil and get enacted relationally. Just to list them briefly, the hindrances are sense desire, or seeking pleasure through the senses, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. And doubt refers to doubt about the teachings or the practice in this case. And the five kleshas are ignorance or delusion, attachment or desire, aversion or anger, pride, and jealousy or envy. The first three are often referred to in Zen as the three poisons, and they overlap. You could hear the hindrances and the kleshas overlap, and they contain these first three, which in Zen we call greed, hate, and delusion, as the most fundamental. But actually what's most fundamental is ignorance. This is a very important area of study for practitioners. And I think that in American Zen, many practitioners skip over this because they skip over the Pali Canon. Because we think, oh, we're Mahayana Buddhists. And that's for the Theravadins, the Vipassana people. But it's not true. These are very important early Buddhist fundamental teachings. So the hindrances and the kleshas obstruct our ability to realize and actualize peace, harmony, and the kind of freedom born of recognizing the true nature of reality. However, they shouldn't be thought of as obstacles to practice. They're actually the path of practice. You know, I was thinking, if there were no environmental problems, there would be no environmentalists. If there were no economic problems, there'd be no economists. No disease, no medicine. No suffering beings, no Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So the path of the problem is the path of the solution. It's one. In other words, we use the very ground on which we fall to get up, which is a Zen expression. The truth of what appears as the antagonizing relationship between delusion and realization. The truth of it is that they actually depend on each other for their freedom, for their existence, and for their liberation. As we can hear so clearly in Dogen Zenji's teachings, you know, all of his practice hyphen realization, practice hyphen verification, practice hyphen enlightenment. And you could say, you know, and he says explicitly that enlightenment and delusion are not separate. And we could say that the practice is the delusion. It's like delusion hyphen enlightenment, because without delusion we would have no practice. The delusion is sort of what we're practicing with. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff Record titled Medicine and Disease Cure Each Other, sometimes translated Medicine and Disease Subdue Each Other. And in that koan there is a line, the whole earth is medicine. I think one translation is the whole world is medicine. But in order to actually experience, you know, the union of medicine and disease, we have to practice in a way that settles and tames the mind, that generates these false, incoherent notions that give rise to our delusions of separation and fuel our conflicts. That separation is like a dangerous gap between our intentions and our impacts. I think it's like a manhole in the middle of the road at night that we're running toward blindly. In order to tame the mind, we have to study our own afflictions. To do that, we need to be brave, frankly, to look honestly and directly at them without defending them, without rejecting them. In this way, I have experienced, I believe, we cultivate the capacity to actually experience some happiness when we recognize our mistakes. You know, through this practice, we can transform our neurophysiological responses to seeing incoherence, to seeing what gets in the way. We can feel like, ah, I caught it. I see it. You know, that's so then when we start to positively associate that, we have repattern ourselves. Maybe we get a hit of endorphins. With a strong intention and discipline, we repattern our nervous systems. I know discipline is not such a popular word these days, if ever it was, but it's true. Practice requires discipline. What was it that David Bohm said at the end of the clip that we just watched? The major source of unhappiness is that we are incoherent and therefore producing results we don't really want, and then trying to overcome them while we keep on producing them. So we have to cultivate the ability to slow down and to stop. Human beings have developed a very high tolerance for suffering, both adaptively and maladaptively. You know, and many people even pride themselves on this high tolerance. They may think it means they're strong. And some people are supremely strong for many unfortunate reasons. They may think that their strength, sometimes their brute force, makes them competent. you know, and therefore more valuable than people with less tolerance for suffering. The Buddha taught that the basic cause of suffering is clinging and aversion. Before, as I said before, more fundamentally the cause is misunderstanding, which we call often ignorance. I'd like to share a quote as I bring this to a close from the Zen and Vipassana teacher Gil Fronsdal, from an essay that he wrote titled Intolerance to Suffering, in a collection of his essays titled The Issue at Hand. He wrote, "Buddhism is often considered a religion of tolerance. In many ways it is, but a particular kind of intolerance develops as we practice. Intolerance to suffering. I use the word intolerance to be deliberately provocative, to encourage you to reflect on suffering and the issues surrounding it. Taking suffering seriously is an important element of Buddhist practice. To ignore it is to miss a powerful opportunity. People are often quite tolerant of their suffering, particularly of the subtle suffering in everyday activities. For example, we may not pay attention to the subtle tension in the way we drive, going a little faster than is comfortable, judging other drivers, or perhaps being anxious about our destination. Such minor stress tends to build over time, affecting our overall mood. People also tolerate larger suffering. For example, we may be afraid that addressing certain issues in our relationships will cause even more suffering, so we choose not to. Or we may passively tolerate such existential anxiety as the fear of death. We have many ways of tolerating suffering and many reasons for doing so. We may fear the consequences of facing our suffering. We may become numb to it or turn away from it. We can intentionally deny the existence of something that is quite uncomfortable." Unquote. Some people get into Zen Buddhism because they want to transcend all of this. Somehow find a way to leap beyond it and stay in the peaks above the clouds, you know, suspended above all of their worldly problems. But of course it doesn't work. You know, what goes up must come down. So in Zen, I say we are here to learn to go through in a way that is truly transformational and liberative. I once heard Tenshin Reb Anderson say, "People with deluded minds can be enlightened." And then there was a long pause before he went on to say, "While they still have deluded minds." People with deluded minds can be enlightened while they still have deluded minds. He went on to say that through many enlightenments, the mind is gradually transformed. This, I say, is the meaning of the Zen expression, "The horse arrives before the donkey has left." Thank you for your attention. I would like to request that we take a few moments, I think we have a few moments, to break into groups of three, to share with each other in some intimate way that's not overwhelming, and of what this lands on for you tonight, with receptivity and authenticity, to share with each other, if you would. And I'll ring a bell when time is up. Thank you. around our evening Dharma events. By the time it ends, people may mingle and chat a bit, but I think folks are often maybe ready to turn in. So I'll admit that I overheard one thing or two. I didn't mean to say that none of the Mahayana teachings or Zen address the kleshas, only that they are outlined in detail in the Pali Canon. And someone said, I'd like the Satipatthana Sutra. That's the Pali Canon. So I do know many young practitioners who don't read the Pali Canon, and they miss a lot of the details of foundational teaching. So that was what I intended to say. Thank you all so much for your full participation tonight. I'd like to end with a dedication of the merit.